You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Peter Vermees grew up near Philadelphia and played for a year at Loyola, Maryland before completing his college career at Rutgers. He was a first-team All-American and runner-up for National Player of the Year Award his senior year. A goal scorer in college, he scored 21 goals and added 10 assists. He then played in Europe for most of the next 7 years. He's part of the founding of MLS as a member of the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars. After a year there, he played 3 years for the Colorado Rapids before finishing his career with a 3-year stint for the Kansas City Wizards. He was part of the Wizards MLS Cup champions in 2000 when he was named MLS Defender of the Year. He earned 66 caps with the U.S. men's national team, playing in the 1988 Olympics, 1990 FIFA World Cup, and the 91 CONCACAF Gold Cup. He was one of the final cuts for both 94 and 98 World Cup squads. After retiring at the end of the 2002 season, he was named the interim manager for the Wizards in 2009 and was given the full-time role following the season. He's now the longest tenured manager head coach in MLS. 2012, he led the renamed Sporting Kansas City, and the name was changed from the Wizards in 2010. He led them to a penalty shootout win over three-time defending U.S. Open Cup champion Seattle Sounders. The following year, Vermees Club won the MLS Cup in a 10-round penalty kick shootout. Makes him the only person ever to win MLS Cup as a player and as a coach with the same team. Vermees also managed Open Cup champions in 2015 and 2017. On August 4th, 2018, Vermees coached his 302nd regular season match, a 1-0 victory over the dreaded Houston Dynamo, becoming the all-time leader in games coached with one club in MLS history. And October 3rd of this past season, Vermees won his 150th regular season match, again with a victory over the Dynamo, becoming only the fifth coach in MLS history to do so. Peter, welcome to Sports Connections.
It's good to be here.
When you came to Kansas City in 2000, did you have any idea that you'd spend the next 20 plus years and hopefully long time beyond that?
No, not at all. Actually, my wife and I are from the same town in New Jersey where I grew up, a town called Delran. And when we got traded to Colorado, it was kind of our contention that when I was done playing, we're going to move back to New Jersey. And so I had in 2000, when I came here in January. We had two small children still in school. So she came in June. And so she spent about 6 months here. We went back for Christmas to New Jersey. We're driving back to Kansas after Christmas. And my wife said, I never want to move back to New Jersey.
Really?
And I was like, really? And she said, yeah. Now, got to understand, I've lived all around the world. So yeah. it didn't matter to me as much, but I was surprised by that. And so, here I am 20 years later, same place. But I have to say, there's something about Kansas City. You know, somebody told me a great little line. They said it's sticky. When you come to Kansas City, it's sticky. And so it has been for me. It's been a great place to raise my family. It's been a tremendous place to be a part of soccer and the growth of it in MLS and on the youth level. So I've been very fortunate to have spent as much time in one place, especially in my profession.
It's interesting. I'd not heard that expression. Those of us who have lived here for a long time, when we think Kansas being sticky, we think of the heat and humidity from about Memorial Day until maybe early October. It gets pretty sticky out here, but I understand what you're saying. This city grows on you. And I lived in New York for a while, but I was from here originally. But it really, it's a big, small town. So it's got that small town approach with plenty to do.
Agreed. I can't say enough about the people, and just a sense of community here. Honestly, it's just a pleasure to be a part of.
Well, good. Now you were here for 3 years as a player, and now more than 12 seasons as manager. Has one been more fun than the other?
It's a lot easier as a player. That's for sure. As a player, you only have to worry about yourself. When you're the manager, you have to worry about everybody. So there's a different satisfaction to it all. Probably much more rewarding as a manager just because of the breadth of oversight that you have to have, and mm-hmm. trying to get so many different groups of people to be committed and focused, you know, not just for one thing, but for a long time, a consistent amount of time, right?
Right.
And you know, you can get a group to just look at a final. That's one thing. But to get someone to consistently do it over the course of a year and then get a group to do that, that's where it's incredibly rewarding and satisfying at the end of the season.
And I would imagine even carrying it from one year to the next. I mean, yeah, each team is unique in and of itself, but there's so much carryover to see the guys that were part of the team last year teach that to the new guys. Imagine it makes your job easier, but two, it probably is very rewarding to see that what you taught stuck, to use that term again, with these guys, and now they're carrying it on to their teammates.
It's true. What I would also say is that you have to have a very good staff that also understands the different levels of people that are entering your team at different times, right? So if you had a guy that's been with you for the last 5 years and really understands kind of your system of play and your culture, and then you got a guy who's only been with you a year, and then you got a brand new guy coming in. And so do you communicate? How do you work with those people on an everyday basis? And it takes a lot of planning, takes a lot of preparation, and a lot of focus by the staff to make sure that everybody and all of their needs are accounted for.
You've got another role besides being manager in other sports, head coach, but you're also the technical director, and that's basically the equivalent of the general manager. Is that right?
That's correct.
So that seems to be pretty hard. We you know, here in Kansas City, we're big Andy Reid fans, and he really got successful when he gave up the player personnel department and just focused on coaching. How hard is it to be the manager and the technical director?
I think that if I was coming into the league or coming into a club just directly, so if, for example, I wasn't here and I went to another club, I'd probably just go in as the manager, probably be a little different for me. The fact that I've been, if you will, the general manager, I first started and then I eventually took on the coaching role, it worked that way. I don't know if right off the bat, if I would have just gotten the opportunity to be at the club, if I would have taken on both roles, but having done it for as long as I have, it works for me. It works for me for a lot of reasons. And probably the simplest way to say it is when I'm interested in a player, right? And I'll use this as my example. All I have to do is look in the mirror and say, "Hey, you okay with this player?" And I say, "Yeah." And then good. I don't get an argument.
Yeah.
Where I think sometimes, as you know, we know in all sports, there's a difference of opinion between the general manager and the coach, and then that can lead to, obviously some relationship problems and things like that. Where I get to live and die on the sword based on those decisions, and so I actually enjoy it that way right now.
And I'm guessing on the front end it makes it easier because you can pick players that not only fit your coaching style but fit the salary cap, fit the culture in the locker room, all those things. But I bet it makes it harder on the back end with somebody who has been just an integral part of the success for you as the manager, that now you have to say, as the technical director, as the general manager, sorry, we don't need you anymore. And I know I'm oversimplifying that, but that's what it comes down to.
No, it's a fine line, right? It's because also the other side, you could say it another way too. You could say, have a player comes to me and says he wants X amount of dollars, and I say no. But then he eventually signs his contract. He's disappointed. Maybe he didn't get exactly what he wanted to. And now I'm telling him he's got to run through a brick wall for the team. and I got to manage that piece as well. And so, I think there's – when you're in this business, I think, again, having experience as having been a player and been in front of a lot of general managers, and I basically did all my own contracts. I didn't have an agent. I had an agent for 3 weeks, and I got rid of them because it just didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And so having that experience, the way I look at it is that I've always felt that – once you sign your contract, it's time to move on and do the business. And I always wanted to treat players how I wish I was treated, mm-hmm. not necessarily how I was treated, but right, really right. more of how I wish I was treated. And I look, I'm upfront, I'm honest. It's not always, not everybody wants that. They think they do. But when they find out, then they're maybe not very happy, but I do believe that just being straightforward and honest and the last thing is that it's a very difficult situation. You've had players that have been successful for the club. You've had relationships with them. And then, you know, at some point, maybe it's time to move on. It's time to separate ways. And the way that I have learned over the years, that I have to deal with that is at the end of the day, my responsibility is to the club. And I have to manage the club, and I have to manage not just today, but a year from now, 3 years, 5, 10. And to do that, I have to make decisions always that are in the best interest of the club. And whether that is on a competitive perspective or a financial perspective. And what I will say is that we try to do it always with the utmost professionalism.
Sure. Now, as a player, you started your career, as I alluded to, as a goal scorer. And you ended your career as one of the best defenders in the league. Talk about how that transition happened.
I was in New York in 1996 when it was the induction of the league. It was the first year of the league. And you can imagine when you had all the teams in the league trying to build teams. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of holes in the team. And our coach got fired, I think, after 6 games. A new coach came in, very well-respected coach, came in from Europe. His name is Carlos Quiroz. He was Portuguese. Very, just a very good coach. And he recognized something in me early that first I was a captain of the team, but he recognized that I had a good attitude in that I was willing to do whatever it took for the team to be successful. And so if that meant I had to play a different position, I play a different position. You know, there are players that sometimes they're like, hey, I don't play there. I'm not playing there. This is where I play.
Yeah.
And I understand that happens with guys, but I wasn't like that. I just really always, my biggest thing was I wanted to win. That was my biggest thing. And so I think he recognized early on that I was willing to fill those holes whenever needed. About 6 games left in the season, he came to me and says, I have a new challenge for you today or for this week. So I said, what's that? He said, well, you're going to play as a central defender. And I said, well, Carlos, I said, I've never really marked anybody. Those guys always marked me because I was the forward. He says, I understand, but I just believe that, you know, with your intelligence on the field, that you'll be able to handle it. Da, da, da. So went into the game. I was playing against, at the time, one of the best center forwards in the league at that time. His name was El Tanque, but he was a Ecuadorian center forward, played for LA Galaxy. And, He was tough, but we wound up winning the game 3-1, and we had a little altercation, more of a contact situation. And I headed the ball, followed through, headed him in top of his eye and split open his eye, and he was out for the rest of the game. So he never scored, which was great. We won. And from that point on, I started playing central defender. And to be honest with you, it's all because of attitude and just wanting to be on the field and wanting to win.
That's interesting. I didn't realize it was so sudden. I mean, it was like one game you're a forward, you're a striker, you're one of that's pushing the next game you're stopping that. And it sounds like it was not only quick, but a good transition that you adapted to being a defender very easily.
I actually think it was a pivotal moment in my career. I really do. I think for a number of reasons. First is I think it, gave me a longer career. I think it would have been more difficult up front because now I could read the game and I could use my intelligence by reading plays, anticipating things much earlier. I've also been a very outgoing person, so it was easy for also me to organize. It's kind of my personality. So I could organize people around me and, again, use my experience in the game to help do that. And then it also has helped me being a manager today just because – I think if I would have played as a center forward my whole life, my whole career, I don't think I would have had as much appreciation for defending as I do. I probably would have thought that winning 5-4 is better than winning 1-0. And really, I think just the opposite. I think that you can't win championships without being able to defend. And so I have a great appreciation for it. And more importantly, I understand the nuances of it. And I think it's helped me immensely as I've been coaching here for a number of years. Because if you look at, you know, my tenure here, the majority of the time we're probably in the top three teams in the league in goals against. And it's right, been, it's always a big staple of who we are.
And I want to ask you about that in just a second, but I have one other question to follow up, you know, what you were just saying. Is that when the coaching bug first hit, when you switched to defense and you thought, you know what, I understand the whole game. You know, you looked in the mirror, like you were talking earlier, and said, I understand the whole game. I understand that there's a difference between 5-4 and 1-0. Is that when that happened?
Yeah, no, I'd say no. Actually, when it hit me was when I was 13 years old. When I was 13, I was asked to participate in a clinic, a coaching clinic. A coach of mine was doing, and he asked me if I would be sort of like a counselor for him, assistant, a demonstrator in there. And so I said, sure. So I did it. And when I did the demonstration and now the kids were to go out and start, you know, performing what it is that I had just demonstrated. Mm-hmm. He was walking around. There was a lot of other kids. So I was walking around and kind of assisting, kind of telling him, well, you do it this way or whatever. And it was interesting because I knew I could feel it after that day that it was really something that was comfortable to me.
Yeah.
It's strange. And I felt that at 13 years old, you know, it sounds really young, but I just felt very, very like it just felt a part of me. And yeah. So I always knew I wanted to coach one day.
That's cool. That's cool. Now you talked about your coaching style reflecting an emphasis on defense. Is it more accurate to say that your coaching style reflects the talent you have on your roster? Because when you didn't have a number nine, when you didn't have a striker, you were very focused on defense. When you had, you know, a couple of years ago, you got several guys you could interchange, the Johnny Russells and guys like that. And then you were more offensive than in the past. Is it accurate to say that your coaching style reflects the talent you have on your roster that season?
I think that we always have this idea that we want to defend a certain way.
Yeah.
I don't think that's ever been different in any of the teams that I've participated in. I think sometimes what happens is personnel can change the way you do things, right? They can make you evolve in a way that sometimes you wanted to, sometimes you weren't sure you were going to, and sometimes you're surprised by in a good way. And so I would say more of our league is always evolving. Our league is becoming a league that's very difficult to break teams down in. So if you want to break a team down that's in a low block or parking the bus, if you will, then you obviously need more quality players in the attack. Mm-hmm. And so I think what has happened is we've been able to, and a lot of it has to do with the league and some of the initiatives that they've come up with, that we've been able to recruit more and more attacking style players, which has helped us on the goal scoring side. But I would tell you that I'm probably pretty consistent in this, and that is I play same formation all the time, 4-3-3. There's been variations of the pressing game that we've done over the years. And the final piece is that we've always had a strong emphasis on being able to defend as a unit. Sometimes it always doesn't work out as yeah. you planned. And sometimes, you know, there's key players that, whether they get injuries or what have you, they're not in for you, and it really affects things. But I would say all in all, very similar idea of how we want to play. It's just that the team has evolved because of players brought in over the years.
Sure, sure. How has the MLS changed in the 25 years of its existence?
Well, it's so many different areas. I mean, if you just talk first, facilities. The facilities are brought on because when you know, I think the first, there was probably three ownership groups in the very beginning, and they owned all the teams. And now you have we'll have in a couple of years, about 30 teams, and you have individual ownership for every one of those teams. That creates competition, that pushes each club to say, hey, we're better than you in these areas. And one of those areas is, for example, facilities. Everybody has their own stadium pretty much, except for a few still kind of share with an NFL team. And then you have the money now that we can spend on players has changed with the introduction of the TAM player, the DP, the designated player,
right.
All of those things have changed our game because the quality of player on the field has changed. So what happens is that if I always think this is an interesting point, and that is when you have more money, usually you put it into attacking players. Well, what has happened over the years, the attacking players have obviously across the league have just increased per capita per team. Well, now all of a sudden teams start to realize, well, we got to get better defensively because these guys are so good up front.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there's this yin and yang that you're constantly battling. How do you use your money appropriately to build a balanced team? And our league has evolved in that regard. And I think that quality of play on the field has then demonstrated it in the fans that are now watching and celebrating and are focused on their teams and their cities. And uh-huh. You see that by the fans and everything else. So I think in those areas, it's increased immensely. And the last piece, and I already stated it, but the owners that are coming into the league, they really love the game. It's funny. They come in, they don't really know. Some don't know a lot. And all of a sudden they become the biggest advocates of the game. So they have really, really taken on the idea of being a really successful club. And that's been great for our league.
Now it's interesting. You've achieved a lot of success as the technical director in a small market. And it's probably a little easier in soccer than it is in baseball, you know, with the huge disparity. But how have you been able to bring in the Alan Politos and the Johnny Russells and guys like that, that are, you know, were you having maybe not outbid, but there's teams in bigger markets that have an advantage there. Have you been able to do that?
It's a really good question. I think if I didn't have the tenure that I have here, I think it would be more difficult because, as you know, just soccer is the same way, especially all over the world. It's just like all the rest of the sports, right? Team's not doing so well. Boom, you fire the coach and you move on.
Right.
Problem with that is that when a player gets recruited by a coach and now that coach gets fired, now the player is in a little bit of a iffy situation, right? They have to now prove themselves to the new coaches. Did they fit into the new coach's system? Just all those things. And so I have – you know, I've always stated to the players, I said, look, the guy that's recruiting you, the guy that's bringing you in is the guy that's going to be here while you're here.
Right.
And I do think that is an important aspect for a lot of players. So, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to – recruiting is a difficult thing, as you said. Small market. We're always fighting against the New Yorks and the LAs. Players always want to go to those places when they come to our league. But I think, you know, again, I think it's that. I think it's the facilities. I think it's the club, the culture, the identity, and our style of play. I think a lot of players are attracted to that as well. And I think all those things, when you add them up together, it winds up being a really good place. And I have the ability to do this, right? We talked about it earlier on. Being here 20 years, there's a lot of players that also want to live in a place where they can actually be with their family and not be under the microscope every second. And so I always tell them that, As much as this is a sports town, the people are very respectful of your time and your space. And so it's a great place to live your life with your family as well.
I had the opportunity to interview Jimmy Nielsen recently, and he's, as you know, back in Kansas City. When he finished his coaching career, he asked his kids and his wife, where do you want to live? He said, you know, grew up in Denmark. He could have lived anywhere. And they all unanimously said, we want to go back to Kansas City. So that's probably got to be part of the appeal when bringing people in to say, hey, I can give you a list of players who played here, who stayed here even after their careers were done. That's got to help, doesn't it?
It does. And frankly, anytime we're recruiting players, and if one of our former players is from that country, it's really easy for me to pick up the phone and say,
yeah.
Hey, why don't you reach out to this player and just explain to them, you know, what it's like here. And, that's always a big help as well. But again, having been here for as long as I have, I have those connections and those relationships, yeah, right? Yeah. It takes time to build those.
For sure. The hardest question I can ask a coach, but I'll ask it anyway. Who are some of your favorite players who have played for you in all those years?
Wow. There's a lot of them. I mean, there's a lot of players, and I think they're always associated to the teams. It's hard to single individual guys out. Look, you brought up Jimmy Nielsen, right? Jimmy's probably as interesting as it can be, because how we got a deal done. Probably one of my fastest deals I've ever done with a player. And you have to understand, we try to spend a lot of time when we're recruiting a player. We do all of our scouting. I can't tell you how many games we watch, and you know, we try to talk to the player individually. We do everything we can. And we were in preseason, and it was a really difficult situation because our number one goalkeeper was holding out. The number two goalkeeper was with the same agent as the number one goalkeeper, so he was holding him out as well. So we're in a real bind. And yeah. And be frank, I thought these deals were going to be done. And this was early on in my career. And interestingly enough, we saw a video of Jimmy in practice in Denmark. And it was about 30 seconds long. It was a small-sided game. A guy was coming at him from the other team, dribbling past him. His defender was in front of him, and he was, you know, telling him to get back. Guy took a shot, whatever, scored. The player that he had talked to, at the end of the day, kind of flipped him off a little bit, right? Mm. Jimmy goes on a beeline straight out and goes after him, and they get into a fight. And I remember saying, that's the guy I want on this team. And so I called him, got on the phone with Jimmy, talked to him for 30 minutes on the phone. 6 hours later, we had a contract.
Wow.
And that's not normal.
Yeah.
But also his impact in the club, in the city, in the community, to help us win, his presence, just fantastic. But we've had a lot of those guys here. Matt Beisler, Sestanovic, those guys have been stalwarts in our club. Chance Myers, Nagamura, Roger Espinoza, who's still with us. Mm-hmm. I know I'm leaving guys out. Yeah. Kai Kamara, CJ Sapong, Teal Bunbury. All these guys have been just very, very good players over the years for this club. And hopefully I'm going to continue to come across a lot more as we move forward.
Well, I'm not going to ask you how long you think you'll be coaching, because Bill Snyder once told me, if you think it's time to retire, it's time to retire, if you're even considering it. But a lot of Sporting Kansas City fans are concerned that you'll leave Sporting Kansas City and take over the U.S. men's national team. What are the chances of that happening?
You know, I've been asked this question a lot, and I'd say this. I'd say that I think for any coach to coach their national team is a incredibly humbling opportunity. I love what I do here at Sporting. I love what I do. I really do. I mean, I've had opportunities to leave here, and I haven't left. And I haven't left because I believe in the project here. I love everything about it. And I think there's still a lot of work to do. I don't know if that will ever happen. I'm a pretty calculated person when it comes to those types of things.
Yeah.
And so it would have to be right for me. I'm not saying that they're offering it. I think Greg Berhalter is doing a tremendous job. So I'm sure he's going to be in that job for a long time. And I plan on being a coach for a long time. So I don't know if that job was ever to happen, or any job was ever to happen for me. It would always have to be on its merits, right? There's certain things that are really, really important to me if I think it's an appealing job. And so it's so hard to just say, oh, would you do that? Because I have to know all the intricacies that go with the job before I would ever make a decision like that.
One of your former players, and I won't say which one, I've interviewed a few of them, said they didn't think it would ever happen because you wouldn't be able to handle the downtime. You know, you are so calculated. You are so, you know, everything's according to the schedule. And there's a lot more downtime with the men's national team. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Yeah, I do. I love, it's one of the reasons why I think I can do both jobs, right? The GM and the manager, is that I enjoy the busyness of it. I don't like downtime. And so I love to be able to kind of during the day, switch hats and do different things. And I think I have a unique quality, and that is I really love the details, but I see the vision. And a lot of times you do one or the other, not both. And I think I have both of those and I enjoy it.
Yeah, that I think that's a good way of summarizing it. Just, I want to wrap up with this. We're running out of time. Just talk about the growth of American soccer, specifically in Kansas City, and tie that to the chances of United States competing for a World Cup title anytime soon.
Kansas City is an easy one. You know, I've been here 20 years now, and I remember when I first came, both my kids played soccer, so I know what it's like in youth soccer.
Yeah.
And the landscape of youth soccer has changed immensely. The evolution of where it is today with, you know, you have educated, licensed, professional coaches, you know, coaching in youth soccer, which is much different than a lot of other sports in this country, but very necessary, right? Because this way the sport is. And so we've taken a huge step forward on the educational side that we just didn't have before. And Kansas City has been a big recipient of that, especially that even the place that I'm sitting in here today, which is Compass Minerals Performance Center. It's where also U.S. Soccer works out of with their coaching educational headquarters. And so we have it right here in our backyard. That part has been fantastic. The other is when you look at, and again, we talked about it, there's going to be 30 teams in MLS over here in the next couple of years. And you look at every single MLS club and the MLS Academy and the pro player pathway that all of them have, and how we're developing players so that one day they can play on our first team. That is a system that is not normal in any other sports industry in this country, right? It's done through youth sports, and it's kind of, you just go up through the college system and then you eventually come out. This is a real focused, calculated way in developing players as we move forward. And so I just think that we've grown in so many areas. And what I would suggest is that I think right now we have the most talent that a national team coach has ever had exposure to. And so I think this group that we have has the chance of going very, very far in the next World Cup, just because of because of two things. One is the player pool itself and the quality that's in there. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that we have players that are playing in some of the biggest clubs around the world and some of the biggest competitions, which is giving them tremendous experience, which eventually they bring back to the national team. Ultimately, hopefully that helps the national team find success at the international level.
And wouldn't it be perfect if that first World Cup title came on American soil in 2026?
That would be incredible. It'd be incredible for our country in so many ways, be great for our sport. And, you know, anything's possible. We've seen that with so many different sports teams over the years. So let's hope so.
All right. Well, Peter, it's a pleasure to catch up with you in a less formal setting than a normal, you know, manager press conference type thing. I've enjoyed getting to know you even a little bit better, and I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, David. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smail. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smail and his work by visiting davidsmailbooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.